Muddy Knees Media.
Totally Football Show. Don't look now, but football is back. Korea this week, Germany next, and then the world. We catch up on the big news. Plus, there's retro. Let's all meet up in the year 2000 for Chapter 8 of our Champions League story. Plus, Coxie with some problems with his anchor management in the quiz. It's the Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. Paul McCartney there with the band The Beatles Could Have Been, and we're underway with a new Totally Listener. Thank you so much for joining us. Duncan Alexander's here. Hello, Duncan.
Hello, James.
Alvaro Romeo, hola.
Hola, guys. How are you?
Very well, thank you. And look, it's Julien Laurens.
Bonjour, James. Bonjour, everyone.
Right. Exciting times, this, isn't it, with football imminent.
I can't wait for Dusseldorf against Paderborn.
Well, yes.
Yeah.
Have you got any better options?
Jules, who PSG got?
We've got someone in the Champions League that we will smash and then go to the next round and then do the same and then go to the final and do the same.
Right.
No, okay. But what's interesting, you know, about Germany is that the derby between Schalke and Dortmund is supposed to be the next game. It's supposed to be the next match day. However, they're thinking about maybe changing the schedule of the fixtures, not to have these games straight in when you come back, because they don't really know will Schalke fans or Dortmund fans turn up to the stadium and that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. Well, I tell you what, let's get a little bit more of an idea about the Bundesliga's big news that they're going to be returning this 15th of May from, of course, our very own German football expert, Raphael Honigstein. You must be ever so excited.
Yes, I am excited. I mean,
come on.
You know, in a way, it's a bit sad, really, because you know that football's going to come back, but it's not going to be the real full fat football. It's going to be very much a hollowed out skeleton version of the game. And as much as I want to see it, at the same time, you just kind of have to brace yourself that it's not really going to be football as you know it, Jim.
I see. Well, listen, the announcement, which I think caught a lot of people by surprise Wednesday afternoon, but the league is actually meeting today, Thursday. So is this start date of the 15th May definitive?
It will be confirmed today. It was confirmed unofficially, if you will, in a letter to the clubs by the CEO of the Bundesliga, Christian Seifert, on Wednesday evening. I don't think the announcement was, in fact, surprising. It had been very much on the cards. The Bundesliga were very careful not to go public with their optimism, but they had sort of received reassurances by the most relevant prime ministers of the regional, the federal states, that they would okay this, and Merkel effectively rubber stamped it. I mean, she has very little time for football and probably doesn't really understand what all the fuss is about. To give you an indication of where it sits in the priorities, after nearly 3 hours, this was the very last thing on the agenda. She just basically follows in that respect what the prime ministers of the biggest states decide. And they had long sort of made up their mind that they thought football could come back in disguise.
Excellent. Okay. Presumably with what, 78-minute a match format? Would that be what they're doing? Also, Rafa, is it too early, do you think? Has it caught some of the clubs out? Is everybody going to be ready for this earlier restart?
Well, Bremen and Mainz have actually complained because they had slightly different regulations because of where they're situated. Some teams have been training together for 2 weeks, some have had 10 days. Those two clubs have had a little bit less time, and they argued quite strongly that the league should come back 1 week later. But the majority of the clubs, of the 36 clubs in Bundesliga 1 and 2, want this to come back early. I think there are two reasons for this. One is they understand that, you know, keeping everybody in quarantine for 2 weeks before the game is not going to be an easy thing, and it's probably going to be quite hard for players to be away from their families for that long and sort of to be protected from everyone else. And perhaps more importantly, I think the longer this takes to actually start and kick off, the more scope there is for someone to get infected, for something to go wrong, as it did with the Salomon Kalou video. So they want to do this as quickly as possible and sort of lay up the games quite thick and fast to see if they can drive this through.
All right. And Rafa, just briefly, on the subject of if something does go wrong or somebody does test positive, there does seem to be a bit of confusion about what the measures will be, how long a suspension will be and for whom.
Yes, and the confusion is down to the federal system. When somebody tests positive in any walk of life, the local health authority has to make that decision, whether everybody else needs to go into quarantine or how to define the people that he had contact with because of the training not having been full training with full contact. When staff and players have tested positively, they were removed individually, put into quarantine, but the rest of the team, the rest of the staff was allowed back in. If this now happens during a game or after a game, then the local health authority have to take a stand. And I guess the Bundesliga hope and pray that it doesn't come to this, because the last thing they want to see is whole teams and opposition teams going into quarantine halfway through for 2 weeks.
All right. Fingers crossed then, Rafa. And fingers crossed that you'll join us as well next week for a special preview of the brand new gutted out and hollowed version of football returning in the Bundesliga.
It'd be my pleasure, James.
Super, there you go, Box Armour, who was asking for an episode with Rafa telling us a little bit more about the Bundesliga sides so that people can pick a team to support. We'll have a bit of that next week, eh? As regards other European leagues, Premier League, still very much in the blue sky thinking phase. Bottom six helpfully suggesting that they'd play behind closed doors if relegation was scrapped. PFA chief Gordon Taylor coming back with games that last less than 90 minutes. All valid options. 8th of June is the target for a restart of the Premier League. Jules, as we know, Ligue 1 won't be returning. PSG are champions. Spain, Alvaro, what's the story there?
Well, there is an intention for La Liga to return. Javier Tebas has been working really hard on a protocol, but obviously it will be down to the Spanish government to lift the ban on public activities. So as soon as the Spanish government allows it, the clubs will start number one training, number two training collectively, not players separately, and finally playing football. It is expected football to return probably not earlier than mid-June. And this week, finally, the clubs have started conducting tests for football players. Probably in about a couple of days, we will know how many of those players have tested positive. We know that in Bundesliga, 10 players tested positive. That didn't stop the competition from going ahead. And progresses have been made in La Liga. So it is expected that by mid-June, late June, La Liga will start if everything goes as planned.
Mid-June, late June in Spain. Perfect preparation for a Qatar World Cup, where you're going to have temperatures in the kind of high 40s in Andalusia and that kind of thing. Could be very, very interesting. Excellent. Well, before any of that, the K-League, Korea's top division, will actually be starting a new season this Friday, tomorrow for us listeners, perhaps for you as well. The season was delayed from February 29th when it was meant to get underway. Among the emergency measures in place, labelled water bottles, sensible, and excessive spitting being prohibited. Steve Price from Forbes.com is in Seoul. He says the big surprise is that they've actually waited this long.
I mean, these games are, they're behind closed doors, and it kind of felt that the K-League has been waiting because they kind of want to have the games with fans in the stadium. And so they probably could have got away with starting it early if they really needed to, if they were in that situation that the Premier League in England's in, where you've got £1 billion riding on it. Then certainly it's been safe enough to do that here for a while, because the teams have been practicing all throughout the coronavirus. They've been having club friendlies within themselves between like the A team and the B team. So everything's here is pretty much ready to go. Life is almost back to normal apart from two things, and mainly that's the schools. Schools are still off, and the live sport, which is still going to be behind closed doors for a few weeks at least.
I see. Now, a lot of leagues around the world are going to be watching the K-League to see which measures they've adopted, and maybe we can look forward to seeing some of them in other championships. So what measures in particular should we look out for?
I should look out for, I think, people on the substitutes bench. They'll be wearing things like masks. All the fourth officials and stuff will have masks on. Anyone who, if you're playing, of course, you can't play with a mask. That's impossible. But anyone who can get away with it will be wearing one. And they tested all the players. They've set up a program where they tested all the players at the start. And they do basic checks on the day, things like temperature checks to make sure no players have a fever or anything like that, and have policies in place in case a player does, and then they can still move forward with the competition while keeping everybody safe.
I guess the big question, Steve, is what happens if a player does test positive, and the league are talking about suspending that team's fixtures as well as their opponents for 2 weeks. That could snowball pretty quickly, couldn't it?
Well, I think at the moment there's so few cases that pretty much nobody's expecting that to happen. And for that to happen, there'll probably be so many cases within the country that people will be probably thinking about, should we be playing anyway? If there are like one or two cases and you have to suspend the games for 1 or 2 weeks, then that's not really as big a deal as I think everybody's been making it out. Whenever I've read English media about if that happens, what's the point? I mean, clubs have games suspended because of the bad weather and stuff. So that happens anyway within the season. And if it happens because of a disease, then that's still the same situation. You have 2 weeks off, and then once everybody's back healthy again, you can play, and they're perfectly safe by doing that, I think.
And in the meantime, getting the league back underway is a huge opportunity for the K-League, which started off the year without a new domestic broadcasting deal.
Yeah, they've really struggled a bit this year to get a deal that they think is what the league is worth. So they've now getting this attention. They've really gone for it, and they've got these international deals. But they've also really called on everyone they can to help. So they've set up an English language commentary and getting professional commentator from Australia to do that. So they're really pulling out all the stops to try and take advantage of being the only league, or one of the only leagues that's in action, and definitely the only league that's making these kind of efforts.
Okay, well, for at least a week until the Bundesliga returns, they have the spotlight. Steve, that's been brilliant. Thank you so much for filling us in on the K-League.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Steve Price of Forbes.com in South Korea. How about that then? It's going to be a shorter season. The 12 teams in the top tier are going to play each other twice instead of the usual three times, which is an unusual format.
I did visit Seoul in November last year, and they're a massive football country. So I'm sure everyone will be very excited that this is coming back.
Yeah, well, indeed so, particularly when they hear that Friday night's kickoff for the season is last year's champions, Jeonbuk Motors, now managed by Jose Mraz, Jose Mourinho's former assistant, who were taking on last year's cup winners, Suwon Blue Wings. Incidentally, the team who finished behind Jeonbuk Motors last year on goals scored alone, it was one of the tightest title races in years, Ulsan Hyundai, they're going to be taking on Sangju Sangmu, who are, yes, the army team composed entirely of players who are doing the national service. So essentially on loan from other teams. That's brilliant. You've got a kind of like floating best of side in the league.
It's like the Met Police used to be in the, although they're now not policemen, they're players. But also, isn't Son doing his military service at the moment? Can they use him?
Well, presumably, yes.
You know who plays in the K-League, actually? Is Mix Diskerud. You know Mix Diskerud, the US international, mm-hmm. who still is on the books at Manchester City.
There
somehow. He's been a Manchester City player like all his life, pretty much, but he's never played for them. One of those weird transfer, not sure what happened there, but yeah, he's okay. In there.
Bolton Wanderers and Crystal Palace fans will be keen for me to mention Lee Chung-yong, who is part of that Ulsan team who are taking on the Army Boys. Fantastic. Let's get on to some tweets before the first round of the quiz. Serdan writes in, says, when you were talking about the end of the season, 94-95, Blackburn winning, you failed to acknowledge that former Hammer Tony Gale was playing for Blackburn in that final match, and he led the entire Blackburn team in a rousing rendition of I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles at the end, because, of course, West Ham denying Man United victory meant that Blackburn were winners. Equally, says Serdan, West Ham were motivated against Man United because United had Paul Ince playing for them.
Yeah, who they obviously detested and possibly still do because he had been pictured in a Manchester United shirt before even signing for the club, which went down not very well.
Wrong. Utsav Srivastava wants to talk about ads with the lads, perhaps our most cherished running theme. How have you not discussed this one, says Utsav, with reference to the phenomenal 2003 Pepsi advert, Western-themed, which sees Real Madrid players and Man United players face off on a dusty Western street over a can of fizzy pop. It really is genius. Slight hiccup when moody-looking Beckham first speaks.
Pepsi.
But in all other regards, tremendously authentic. It was actually shot in Almeria, Spain, where all the spaghetti westerns were filmed, and was directed by Tarsen Singh, who did the... Do you remember that very, very popular Losing My Religion video for REM? Do you remember this advert, everybody? The Pepsi advert where there's a shootout? It's brilliant. I completely forgot it, but it's really good.
I thought you were going to say that it was directed by Sergio Leone as well, just to round the circle completely. But I always believe that the goalkeepers are humiliated in these ads, because it was an Iker Casillas versus David Beckham. And Beckham scores the goal. Casillas has no chance. I don't know why goalkeepers accept normally to be part of these ads. But at the end, the good thing is that they left it open for a second part, because Roberto Carlos came out from the barber and he was going to take a free kick, and that was the end of it.
Because I think the tagline is leaves you wanting more or something, which actually suggests that their drink is deeply unsatisfying. I'm not sure that that's what the... But anyway, here's Kaz with another favourite ad, the John Barnes Lucozade one. It still makes me want to kick all my rubbish into the bin.
After 90 minutes of share hell, you're going to get thirsty.
Yeah, this I would say this is my favourite football advert in the sense that, you know how there's various phrases you remember through life that you probably say out loud maybe 10 times a year just because they're hardwired into your brain? From this advert, after 90 minutes of sheer hell, you're going to get thirsty. I literally probably say that once a month out loud for no reason. So that's how you know impressive that advertising was.
Julien, do you have a random phrase that you can't help yourself coming out with?
No, I don't, but I'm going to look for one now. Does the Peter Kay one for John Smith count, or does it have to be one that involves professional football players?
I mean, by now we seem to be covering all adverts all the time everywhere, but originally the concept was that it was adverts that were particularly cherished for you almost as much as football matches because you grew up with them and there was something exciting about the composition of the teams or the little narrative twist or whatever.
I think the Peter Kay one is amazing, to have that, you know, when he kicks the ball and he was doing keeping up his. But when we did this on the show and I mentioned the Cage one, that was my favourite, you ridiculed it by saying, oh, but my one is better because the director was... Who was the director of yours? Guy Ritchie?
No. Is it Iñárritu?
Yes. But actually, you know who directed the Cage
Gilliam.
One? We had one of the listeners tweeting, so just have that.
No, Jules, you've had a plebiscite on your
side.
Loads
of
people wanted the Cage. Yeah. But most popular among listeners, don't know if this is your experience, listener, was the Brazil at the airport Nike ahead of 1998 one. That's probably the favourite.
If it was an advert that created a narrative of the way a player played, I'm looking at Ronaldinho's 2002 in Paris, where he plays with some sort of a draw and some freestylers. And that was in 2002, and I believe that no advert had explored the ground of freestyling. And they created that narrative about Ronaldinho that afterwards translated on the pitch as well. I think that ad was kind of iconic too.
Very nice, Alvaro. Well, let's take a quick break now from the adverts in a slight... inversion of the usual practice, because it's time for the quiz as we find the final semi-final list.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power.
Listener, the Intertotally is our quest to find the number one Totally Football pundit. So far, it's been brutal. Rafa out, Nevin out, Julien out, Sasha out. I mean, I could go on. Just this weekend, Horndog out, which means we've got one more quarterfinal to go and another big name is about to tumble as we meet our contestants.
It's time to play the game.
time to play the game.
Up first, he's made it to the quarterfinals despite a quiz debut that could only be described as Jonathan Woodgate-esque.
Oh boy, this is bad. My goodness.
You know he's made of sterner stuff than that, so don't you dare be sour. It is Carl Cerebral Assassin Anchor.
Carl, welcome back to the Intertotally.
It's great to be back.
Great. Some difficulties there in the first round, but as they say, don't look back in anger, eh?
Look, it was a strong first half.
Yeah, 1 point out of five in the general knowledge is something you'll look to better today, I imagine, particularly given who you're up against.
And his opponent, the man who some say already has his name etched onto this trophy. When it comes to footballing knowledge, he knows his apples and he knows your apples too. Oh, speaking of apples, here he is, Michael Cox.
Glad he went with apples there, Michael.
Yeah, that's not the usual comparison that gets made on Twitter. So I'm happy with apples this time around, yes.
Okay. So much expectation riding on your shoulders. A lot of pressure with that, I imagine.
Yeah, a little bit. And I must say, Carl's entry music was quite intimidating as well. I feel like I'm really up for, in for a battle today.
Well, I'm sure you are. You both got 6 out of 10 in the first round. Carl, as we mentioned, one or two issues with the general knowledge, which means specialist subject could be absolutely crucial. What have you both gone for, Carl?
Well, there was some furore over the fact I chose half a season of Southampton, which I disagree with. So I've gone for the 2018 World Cup.
Okay, sounds good. Michael, how about you?
Yeah, I've gone for a tournament as well. I've gone for Euro 2004.
Very good. Carl, you're up first answering questions on the World Cup 2018. Question one. When Belgium came back from 2-0 down against Japan in the round of 16, who scored the late winning goal for them?
I want to say Nasser Chadli.
I assume that's what you're saying?
Yep, Nasser Chadli is my answer.
Is correct. Question two. Harry Kane won the Golden Boot. But who won the silver boot at World Cup 2018?
Oh, Kane got 6 goals. I want to say Romelu Lukaku with 4 goals?
It was Antoine Griezmann who finished ahead of 4 others because he got more assists.
Oh.
Harsh, but fair. Question 3. Which player in England's squad had just been relegated from the Premier League when he was picked?
Huh. So that's the end of the 2017-18 season. It would be Jordan Pickford, surely?
It was Jack Butland who'd just gone down with Stoke. Question 4. Which team were knocked out of the last 16 stage for the 7th World Cup in a row?
This is a curse. It's the curse of 16. It's Mexico.
It is. And question 5. What was unusual about the penalty that Antoine Griezmann scored in the final against Croatia?
It was a VAR-assisted penalty?
That is correct, Carl. Well rescued. At the end of your specialist round, you have a respectable 3 out of 5.
Okay. Not bad.
Let's see if Michael Cox can better that, answering questions on Euro 2004. Michael, question 1. Wayne Rooney became the youngest ever scorer in the European Championships when he found the net against Switzerland. But who broke his record just 4 days later?
It was a Swiss player called Von Lathen. Von Lathen?
Von Lathen is correct. Johan Von Lathen. Question 2. Who scored a late winner for Italy in the group stage and thought he'd put them through, only to discover that Sweden and Denmark had drawn 2-2, a scoreline that ensured both those nations qualified?
I think, and I'm only saying this because I can remember him kicking a water bottle in frustration and then falling over, which was very funny. I think it was Antonio Cassano.
It was. Question 3. Which two England players missed in the penalty shootout defeat to Portugal?
One was Vassell, who missed the decisive one. And I believe the other one was David Beckham.
That's correct. All right, you're level now with Carl. Question 4. Which is the missing team from this list of Greece's opponents in the tournament? Portugal, twice. France, Russia, the Czech Republic, and one other nation. Who is it?
So it would be in the group stage, and it would be Spain.
Correct. And question five, for a perfect first round score, what was manager Otto Rehhagel the first to do when Greece won the tournament?
I can only assume it's to win it with a country which isn't his own.
That is correct. He was the first foreign manager to win the European Championships. Good Lord, 5 out of 5, Michael.
Oh, that used to be me.
Yeah. No, it was, to be fair, I thought Cole's questions were very tough. I certainly wouldn't have got right the ones that he got wrong.
Just a 2-point lead then. And a mighty, mighty performance ahead if Carl Anker is to challenge for that last semi-final place. We'll be back with you guys later on for that. How about that then? Michael with a 5 out of 5 in the specialist subject.
Good to see both players go for wide-ranging specialist subjects as well, given recent controversies. Thought the Butland question was quite tricky in Carl's one, because you never know whether Jack Butland's actually injured or available. So,
Alvaro, you're the only person present who's actually still in this tournament.
I am.
How on earth did you go that far? What happened?
Well, Duncan Alexander lost in the first round. Hello, Duncan.
Hi, Alvaro. I mean, I'm backing you because
I don't know how, but I won the second round as well. Pat Nevin basically melted off in the general knowledge questions. And he helped me a lot.
Duncan, did you lose? You lost to Alvaro?
Did you not hear about
that? How come you're allowed on this podcast ever again?
How'd you go?
This is your job, quizzes and stuff. You host the best quiz
ever. I write a lot of quizzes, yeah.
But right. You don't know the answer.
Poacher turned gamekeeper. But, you know, I think if Alvaro wins, it puts my defeat in a much different context. So
that's true.
Jules, anyway, you should be proud to have an international in the semifinals.
Yeah,
and representative.
You're right.
That should be the approach.
We'll see anyway if Carl Anker can come back from that 2-point deficit in the general knowledge, which Michael wasn't all that 100% on when last he competed. But that'll be later on. Right now, it's time to go retro with Chapter 8 of our Champions League story.
I'm Jose Mourinho. I know a thing or two about being special. Extra large laundry baskets? Special. Winning the daily jackpot on Paddy Power games? Not special.
Understood, Jose. Yes, someone wins an average £40,000 jackpot every single day. So if you win, don't think you're special. Daily jackpots by Paddy Power Games. Jackpots must be awarded by 11 p.m. and vary from day to day. Jackpot is shared with other operators. Available on selected games. T's and C's at paddypower.com. 18+.
On Spotify, smart speaker and podcast platforms everywhere, this is the Totally Football Show from Muddy Knees Media.
Champions League 1999-2000. A new millennium, and from the visionaries at UEFA HQ in Neon, a new format. Some felt they never should have left the knockout format for a group stage, but UEFA had an answer. 2 group stages. But 99-2000 was more than just a bloated, unwieldy format. It was also the first year of Spanish dominance, with 3 of the 4 semi-finalists and both finalists. It was Valencia reaching the first of back-to-back finals with the one manager you don't want to go to a final with against Real Madrid. But it was also Redondo doing Man United, fresh new faces like Chelsea and Lazio, and batty goal at Wembley. 99-2000, Jules, you enjoyed this look back.
I loved it, absolutely. I had forgotten how strong the Lazio team was, for example, how good the Fiorentina team was as well. The Spaniards were very dominant, but some of those games were incredible. There's a lot of twists, as we will see when we go through the season. Almost every stage with big clubs who could have gone out and then went find a competitor. There's so much into it. Some of the goals, I mean, Bressan's goal was incredible for Fiorentina. Mm. There was so much to that I had forgotten about, and it was great to look into it again.
Right, that Bressan goal against Barcelona, Alvaro, absolutely astonishing overhead kick from sort of Ibra-esque distance.
Yes, absolutely. And it was one of those goals that that you don't forget, and one of these teams that you don't forget either, because Fiorentina had Batistuta probably at his prime. Also a player that, like Balbo, that he was the perfect sidekick for Batistuta as well. And they did all rightish in the Champions League, considering that they didn't have a lot of experience in the competition.
The goal I remember from that season was Batistuta's incredible strike from a pretty extreme angle against Arsenal at Wembley in the first group stage, and he also struck against United, Duncan.
Yeah, home and away. In Florence, Roy Keane made a untypical, terrible back pass, which he intercepted and lashed home. And then at Old Trafford...
Batistuta! Oh, what a fantastic hit! Speed of light strike from Gabriel Batistuta!
He hits it so hard from about 35 yards. The ball just... And this is the era when balls didn't really move that much. They were a bit heavier, but it moves all over the place and just, you know, flies into the net. You know, he really was incredible in this season, yet, you know, rarely did anything in the competition afterwards. You know, he played 11 games for Roma in 2001-02 and didn't score. So this really was the kind of one flowering season of Batistuta in the Champions League.
Well, Batistuta's legs, of course, were becoming increasingly a problem, so much so that he kind of quipped afterwards that he wanted to have them amputated. They were giving him so much pain. And he managed to drive Roma to the title after making the switch following this particular season. But I think it's fair to say, particularly in Europe, he wasn't by any means as effective. But as you say, Alvar, incredible squad they had in terms of goal scoring. Abel Balbo there, Pedro Mijatovic was with them as well. Also, Enrico Chiesa with a guy named Rui Costa backing them all up.
Yes, they were all very good players. Unfortunately for Mijatovic, his prime came from 94 until 99, and probably he didn't show up all his talent at Fiorentina. Also, we have to remember that his son, Luka Mijatovic, was unfortunately in the hospital at that time, and Mijatovic couldn't actually focus in his footballing career because he had to be with his son all the time. So his time in Italy wasn't great. But... just a word about Batistuta. I mean, he was scoring pretty much like 0.8 goals, 0.7 per game in a time when defenses were more dominant than attacks. Football was different in the early 2000s, and Italian football was the epitome of that. And he managed to be the most consistent scorer in there.
Again, if you want a bit more background on Batty, there is a Golazzo for that. Let's talk about the English sides. Man United were the European champions, but attempts by the Premier League's teams to retain the trophy proved unsuccessful this year. Arsenal, who were drawn in Fiorentina's group, finishing third, dropping into the UEFA Cup, where they would make it through to the final, but would get done by Galatasaray on penalties. The UEFA Cup that year, marked by violence, and in particular the fatal stabbings of two Leeds United fans, Kevin Speight and Christopher Loftus, in Istanbul. Going further in the Champions League were Man United and also Chelsea. Plucky Chelsea, Duncan.
Plucky in the sense that this was the pre-Abramovich era. I mean, they still had, you know, players like Deschamps and Zola, so they weren't sort of, you know, run-of-the-mill. But yeah, they adapted really well. Got through both group stages. I think possibly their key player this season was Tore Andre Flo, who's not a name that people think of much anymore, but he scored 8 goals in this season, in his only ever season in the Champions League. Only one player has played one season in the Champions League and scored more goals than that, and that is his countryman Erling Haaland, who you would imagine is going to go on and play more seasons in the Champions League. Third in that list, for anyone who wants the top three, is Lee Bowyer with 6 in his one season.
Wow.
But yeah, Flo popped up with crucial goals time and again. And yeah, Chelsea got through their two groups and set up a very memorable quarter final against Barcelona, in which the first leg at Stamford Bridge was an absolute classic. Obviously on Monday's pod you talked about the internationalism of the Premier League and how it was kind of, you know, growing in reputation in the mid-90s. I think this game, the start of the new century, was definitely the Premier League first kind of flexing some of its, you know, obviously Man United had won, but this was another team, you know, it was kind of Chelsea coming along, and yeah, they played really well.
Gianfranco Zola with a glorious free kick as Chelsea took a 3-0 lead against Barca in that first leg before Figo pulled a crucial goal back. Of course, the second leg didn't go quite so well at the Nou Camp for the Blues.
Al cinque gol dal Barça en una nit màgica, en una nit de remontada. Barça 5, Chelsea 1.
I remember that Chelsea had a player like Dennis Wise, and he seemed to be a little bit out of context now if you look at the way he played and the challenges he was doing at Camp Nou in the second leg. He did a couple of really, really nasty tackles and he managed to get away with it. And I believe that he was probably one of the the last players that remain from the old times in that Chelsea team, because Gianfranco Zola, was probably one of those contemporary players who was short, but he was relying on technique and the managers didn't mind about it.
Jules, the second leg had a pretty emphatic scoreline, but the outcome was anything but a foregone conclusion.
Yeah, you're right. And Chelsea, who obviously had the 3-1 lead from the first leg, defended really well. And it's only in the 83rd minute that Dani Garcia, the young striker for Barcelona at the time, would come on, score to make it 3-1, so to take the game into extra time. I think after extra time, the Chelsea players' legs had gone and it was easier for Barcelona, and they scored two more goals. But 7 minutes more and they would have gone through to the semi-final for their first ever, as we said, appearance in the Champions League. Was pretty impressive. And I think just quickly on the that's when Deschamps arrived, and Viali was obviously the manager at the time, and the Deschamps Desailly partnership was reunited. They were reunited together. If you remember, they were together in the academy in Nantes, and the whole friendship that lasted forever and still on now was really happened, and they bonded when Desailly lost his brother in a car accident when Marcel was really young, and so was his brother, who was a very promising, talented football player as well. And Deschamps being roommate with Desailly at that time, they got so close, almost like they were a brother. And Deschamps very much replaced Desailly's real brother by being together. And I think they always wanted to play again together after the year in Marseille. And that time at Chelsea was very much, no, it was not the greatest Deschamps, even Desailly, but for them to be together again at club level was very important.
Wow. Were rooms assigned at Nantes on alphabetical basis, do you think?
No, that's a good question. I don't think they were, but they were very similar in terms of personalities then as a 15-year-old. And it just worked out well, and as well that the two names are very close too.
That's lovely, because you often hear about there's no real friendships in football. I didn't know those two were besties.
Yeah, they were, yeah.
Just on Barcelona's attack, they scored. I mean, obviously, there were more games this season. This is the only time in Champions League history we've seen outfield players play more than 1,500 minutes, just purely because there was so many opportunities to. But Barcelona scored 45 goals, which is more than any other team have in Champions League history. That's 9 more than Burnley did when they came 7th in the Premier League in 2017-18. So it felt kind of inevitable that, you know, that they would score in every game, which they pretty much did. But their defence was a bit ropey. I'm sure Alvaro will know more than me on that. But I think possibly you could argue that Chelsea were a little bit defensive in that second leg. You know, they had a midfield that day, starting midfield of Dennis Wise, Deschamps, Jody Morris and Di Matteo. So not that much creativity in there.
Yeah, following up on that, I mean, Barcelona had Frank de Boer injured for a good part of that season, and he was probably the best defender they had. And then for that game, for example, against Chelsea, the guy who played left back was Zenden, who was obviously a left winger. So that tells you a little bit of how prompted Barcelona was to overcome the deficit. But number two, that Luis Van Gaal was no scared of playing with an attacking system. And in fact, Barcelona at that time was playing with two attacking midfielders like Cocu and Luis Enrique, who were capable of scoring more than 10 goals per season. That was adding up to the lot. And then they had Patrick Kluivert up front, who was a good striker, surrounded by Rivaldo, the Ballon d'Or of 1999, and who was going to be the Ballon d'Or in 2000, Luis Figo. So both players, Rivaldo and Figo, picking for Barcelona at the same time was something that Barcelona should have profited more. And it's a real shame for them that they didn't win the Champions League, having those quality players in the squad.
Well, semi-finalists Barcelona that season, but not finalists. Before we get on to the two teams who were, what else stands out for you? I must admit, you mentioned Lazio, Jules, and they actually were victorious, of course, against Chelsea at Stamford Bridge, a 2-1 win for Sven-Göran Eriksson's Lazio at the time. One of their goals coming classic fashion from Sinisa Mihajlovic, again from a pretty ridiculous angle.
Mihajlovic, area affollatissima, prova il tiro, proprio lui, Mihajlovic.
Worth just having a quick look back, as this guy's famous for a lot of things, currently battling against leukemia. But numbers-wise, at least, has there ever been a better player on free kicks than Mihajlovic?
I think it's a great debate. I think Juninho Pernambucano, when he was at Lyon, was probably the closest that it will ever be to Sinisa Mihajlovic. I mean, Messi not being included. And again, it was a different style of taking free kicks. But I think Mihajlovic and Juninho were certainly very close on how they hit the ball and how they went through the ball compared to someone like Messi or even someone like, I don't know, Pjanic or Platini, who were more with the inside curling the ball and stuff like that. Mihailovic and Juninho, Mihailovic especially, was pure brutality in many respects. And that goal he scored from a very tight angle. Paulo Dybala scored a very similar one this season in the Champions League with Juventus against Atletico Madrid.
The thing about Mihailovic, beyond technique and that, just in terms of numbers, I don't know who can compare. He was certainly the number one guy in Italy. Scored more than 70 free kick goals in his career. He had better figures in Serie A than Maradona or Zola. He also hit the woodwork apparently 40 times with his set pieces, and not once did it deflect in.
That's impressive. I think Juninho is 56, maybe. So Mihailovic clearly has scored more as well.
Anything else, Jules, from the 1999-2000 season before we get onto the lads in the final?
Well, if we focus on the group stages and especially the first part of them, Rangers had a very good campaign that season, to the point that before their last game in that group stage away in Munich against Bayern, a Bayern team that had been so far very underwhelming, they were second ahead, 1 point ahead of Bayern Munich. So a draw in Munich would have been enough for Rangers to actually qualify and go to the second group stage. They lost 1-0 and conceded a goal in the second half, but they were very close of knocking out Bayern Munich from the Champions League. And then Bayern obviously went on to go into the semi-final. But it was a very good campaign, those first six games for Rangers.
Bayern, who were, of course, the runners-up from the previous Champions League campaign. France, meanwhile, Marseille and Bordeaux were the two representatives. But Jules, perhaps the most crucial contribution from French football was the venue for the final. Like when Premier League used to be excited about having the referee.
Yeah, it's good. Although Marseille and Bordeaux being there, there was a lot of controversy because in 1999, Bordeaux won the title and Marseille were second. And it was all down to the last game of the season. And guess where Bordeaux were playing on that last game? They were playing in Paris against PSG. And I think now we can all reveal that PSG let Bordeaux win to make sure that Marseille didn't win the title that season. And it's a game that Bordeaux won 3-2 and scored the third goal in the dying seconds of the game once PSG let them score to win 3-2 in Paris and be crowned champion ahead of Marseille.
I'm Jose Mourinho. I know a thing or two about being special. Getting a road named after you in your hometown, special. Winning the daily jackpot on Paddy Power games, not special.
Understood, Jose. Yes, someone wins an average £40,000 jackpot every single day. So if you win, don't think you're special. Daily jackpots by Paddy Power Games. Jackpots must be awarded by 11 p.m. and vary from day to day. Jackpot is shared with other operators. Available on selected games. T's and C's at paddypower.com. 18+. BeGambleAware.org.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Que tous ceux qui sont dans la vibe, lève-toi. Que toutes celles qui sont dans la vibe, lève-toi. Que ceux qui sont assis se lèvent, suive pas. Allez, maintenant, on y va.
Stade de France, the venue for the final on the 24th of May 2000. Streets filled with the sound of Yannick Cicerella, which was number one in France at the time.
It's a song that Yannick, who was a young rapper, adapted from Claude François, one of the most famous, if not the most famous French singer of all time. And Claude François, which his song was called Cette année-là, was already adapted to December 1963. Oh, what a night.
By the Four Seasons. Fab. Anyway, let's talk about the two teams in the final. Real Madrid, of course, are old friends. But tournament new boys, their opposition, Valencia. Alvaro, remarkable two seasons this at the Mestalla, under Argentine manager Hector Cuper, reaching the Champions League final in both of them.
I cannot say I didn't see that Valencia coming, because the season before, they had been spectacular, winning the Spanish Cup and kicking out Barcelona and Real Madrid and Atletico de Madrid in impressive fashion. But they had a new manager, Ranieri left, and they signed Hector Cuper. Well, a manager who is famous now for coming second in every tournament, even though he has won three titles as a manager. A very good manager, actually. And that Valencia had a very good mix of experience at the back with Amedeo Carboni, who is 55 years old now, so that tells you how old he was at the time. They had Jukic as well, they had Anglomas, as far as I can remember. And then in the midfield, they had a really nice technical young structure in there with Gerard, Mendieta, Farinós, and then a very quick striker like Piojo López. So they were a very good team, and they finished La Liga season that year unbeaten in the last six or seven games. So coming into the final, since Real Madrid had a really poor league season with the change of manager from John Tosac to Vicente del Bosque. Coming into the final, Valencia seemed to be the favorite, which seems to be now a little bit strange considering the final score of that final. But that Valencia team ended up being one of those runners-up that fortunately, domestically, they managed to get some titles because they won La Liga in 2002, in 2004, and that somehow make up for the European disappointments.
Right, they won the title once Hector Cooper had, of course, gone to Inter. It is extraordinary, his record. He had been working at Mallorca. He got to the Copa del Rey final, lost that, but by being in the final, got them into the Cup Winners' Cup, where he gets to the final, which they lost to Lazio. But no matter, he then has the two seasons at Valencia, where he gets them into the Champions League finals both times, loses both. He then goes to Italy, where he takes Inter to this final day showdown with Lazio, where he blows that in the most spectacular collapse, or infamous collapse, in that club's storied history. Just remarkable. But equally, the players that came through Valencia. I mean, more recently, the likes of David Silva and Isco. But at the time, Maracas Flute asking, how is it that Valencia team had such a talented squad in 1999-2001? They seem to have had a relatively mediocre or inconsistent mid-90s. What was the story?
Well, I think that they did a very good recruitment. And then they had some really good talented players from the academy. Farinós being one of them. He ended up playing for Inter Milan. Mendieta was probably the biggest star in there. A player who came from the academy, even though Mendieta was born in the Basque Country. And probably Gaizka Mendieta was one of the best midfielders of his time. Let's not forget that he ended up being the UEFA's best midfielder in 2000 and in 2001, ahead of Zinedine Zidane, for example. I'm not saying that Mendieta was better than Zidane, no way. But at the same time, he had really good seasons. So they did a very clever recruitment. They went for the right manager pretty much all the times, with Ranieri, with Hector Cooper, Rafa Benitez afterwards. So I think that something very good happened there. It was a conjunction of really good work done by the players and the sporting direction as well.
Well, they got to the final the hard way, drawn in a group of death not once but twice. They had Rangers, PSV and previous season's runners-up Bayern Munich in the first group. Then in the second group, Bordeaux, Fiorentina and the reigning champions, Man United. And once they'd made it through those 12 matches, they had a quarter-final with Lazio, the team that had beaten Cooper's Mallorca in that Cup Winners' Cup final, where the Argentine got his revenge with a stunning 5-3 aggregate victory.
Centro de Kylian González con mucha intención, Gerard. Gol. Y gol. Gol de Gerard. Despejó balota. El balón para Gerard que acaba de conseguir el 4-1. Valencia 4, Lazio 1.
Woof. They then put Barcelona out.
Yeah, and one of the stars in all those games was a player who unfortunately didn't reach what was expected from him, but it was Gerard López Segú. He was supposed to be the next great midfielder, the next Guardiola. Everybody expected him to be really good, and in the youth ranks, everybody talked about him. And I would say that his peak arrived when he was 21 years old, and he didn't make it any better than that. But in that quarterfinals against Lazio, he definitely killed the team from Roma. And then in the games against Barcelona, he was so good that Barcelona signed him that summer. Basically, Barcelona used the money they got from Figo to sign a player like Gerard, for example, because he was like looking like the next great midfielder in Europe.
And what happened, Álvaro?
I think that Gerard, the problem with Gerard was that he arrived in Barcelona when Barcelona didn't know what style to implement in the team. He had many managers, probably changing from Van Gaal to Radomir Antic to Serra Ferrer to Frank Rijkaard didn't help his development, and he ended up just not being the player everybody expected, maybe because they wanted to make of him like a holding midfielder, and he was actually really good in the box-to-box system, but the Barcelona system at the time was trying to contain that box-to-box initiative ability, and they tried to make a very positional player out of him, and he wasn't a good positional player.
The crazy thing as well about Valencia is in the second group stage, Fiorentina almost could have knocked them out. In the last game, Valencia drew 0-0 with Manchester United, and Fiorentina are 3-1 up against Bordeaux. And at that time, the two teams are level. One more goal, or maybe two more goals for Fiorentina, who were walking all over Bordeaux. But they concede two late goals from Bordeaux to draw 3-3, and then they're 2 points short behind Valencia in that table to qualify for the quarterfinals. So again, another twist, a bit like Rangers and Bayern Munich, that could have seen Valencia being knocked out and Fiorentina progressing.
So this system of having two group stages, which I think most people look back on as a whopping mistake by UEFA, it actually produced, this season at least, some really, really dramatic finales.
Yeah, I think the thing with the two group stages was, the main problem with it for me was that it started before Christmas. You had the first two games before Christmas and then a massive, you know, 2-3 month pause before it picked up again. And I felt the kind of the flow
of this season, though.
Yeah, the flow of the Champions League felt a bit stunted. But yeah, I mean, in terms of kind of action, you can't really, you know, can't argue against it for this season at least.
Well, Valencia had made it through to the final, scoring tons of goals. And there they were to face Real Madrid. Bailamos, number one in Spain that season with Enrique Iglesias, whose dad, of course, used to play for Real Madrid. Hey.
Julio, yes, he was a goalkeeper.
He was.
For Real Madrid until he had an accident and then he switched to singing.
Well, yeah, so he's in the hospital bed and a nurse gave him a guitar. And that's when he learned to play and discover his musical talent. And he became the most commercially successful continental European singer in the world, it says in my notes. But yeah, Julio Iglesias was huge. And so was Enrique. Woof. Real Madrid weren't number one in Spain that year, though, were they, Alvaro? They'd started the season under John Toshak. As you mentioned, he got ditched for Vicente del Bosque, future Spain manager, future Intertotally quiz question. They had sailed through the first group, made it into the second. Things got particularly interesting when they met up with Man United in the quarters.
It did, and probably that game made one of the most iconic dribbles in the Champions League history. That one of Redondo over Berg, I believe, which gets remembered any time there is any excuse for it in Spanish media.
Fernando Redondo. ¡Oh, madre, qué taconazo se ha sacado! De la línea de fondo. Continúa Redondo, la pone hasta Raúl, va a marcar. ¡Gol, gol, 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 gol!
It was on the left wing. Real Madrid was attacking. Fernando Redondo was no way the kind of player who would do these things. But however, he had this lapse of inspiration and he managed to backheel and nutmeg Berg. Then he got into the box and he found Raúl with a very clever pass, and Raúl just had to tap in to score one decisive goal for Real Madrid.
That game also notable. Obviously, Keane and Scholes had both been suspended for the final the previous season, and it felt during the season that they were trying to make up for that. Keane in particular had signed this big new contract with United, but then he goes and scores an own goal to open the scoring for Madrid at Old Trafford. And if you look at it, Scholes absolutely clears out McManaman with a dreadful tackle, but the ball then goes wide, crossed in, Keane slides in, and it led to that chant, you know, popular amongst opposition fans in England for a bit, for £50,000, he'll score for Real Madrid, which is kind of quite haunting now, because that's basically the salary of like a reserve left back now, it sounds, you know, but at the time, this, for £50,000, it's like, whoa, what's he doing there? Kind of strange as well that obviously people remember the United Real Madrid game in 2003 when Beckham came on as a sub, scored late, and Ronaldo got the hat trick. Similar kind of vibe in this one, you know, Madrid take the lead, United kind of fight back, but it's all too little, too late. And this reportedly is obviously the game that Ferguson decides that, you know, their kind of gung-ho approach to European football isn't the way forward, and he tries to kind of remodel the side after this.
Yeah, it's worth remarking that Real Madrid, despite having won the Champions League in 1998, they still didn't have this aura around them of a winning team. That season, for example, they let Deportivo La Coruña win the title of them. Barcelona came second in that league, and Real Madrid, I believe, that didn't even qualify for Champions League. So that game in Old Trafford was a big statement, and Fernando Redondo was probably the best player of that Real Madrid in that game. And it's a real shame that we have missed a player like Fernando Redondo in the international scenario, because he had the problem with Daniel Passarella, the Argentinian manager. Basically, Passarella didn't want players who had hairstyles like Redondo's, or didn't want players who were wearing earrings. And Fernando Redondo refused to change his style.
Mm. because Batistuta had to cut his hair to get into the
Basically, he said that that shouldn't be important, and he didn't play for Argentina for 6 or 7 years for that reason. So we miss Fernando Redondo in World Cups for that.
But that moment against Henningberg at Old Trafford, it's not just the skill, that backheel flick through Berg's legs, but the utter bewilderment of Berg as he tries to process what's just happened and why the ball is completely 6 yards in where it shouldn't be.
The best one is that Berg thinks that the ball is going to come out for a goal kick. So he almost stops running once he's been humiliated by the nutmeg and the backheel flick. And then when he realized that Redondo is actually quick enough to get the ball before he comes out on the, you know, near the line, he tries to come back and he's far too late. And then Redondo picks the pass for Rome.
Real Madrid made it past Bayern Munich with probably the most significant contribution of Nicolas Anelka's time at the Bernabeu, which you'll be surprised to hear was slightly controversial, eh, Alvaro?
Yes, Anelka was a proper character in Spanish football. I mean, I think that he just got to Madrid too young, and he was at the time the most expensive signing in world football, €33 million, and he never adapted to Real Madrid or to that locker room. There is an anecdote that Vicente del Bosque tells that basically Anelka, after scoring his first goal with Real Madrid, he complained in the locker room that nobody celebrated with him, that they weren't happy about him scoring. So that was a little bit the spirit of Anelka and Real Madrid that year. He was also suspended and he didn't get his salary for a number of days because he didn't turn up to few training sessions as well. So that was Anelka in March 2000. But from that point onwards, Vicente del Bosque, who is a man that understands that harmony is the first thing, and he's very pragmatic when it comes to managing to bounce back players that seems to be irretrievable, he managed to get the better of Anelka, at least for a couple of months, and that went in the favor of Real Madrid, because Anelka ended up scoring very important goals in that championship campaign.
Can I tell the truth now about the Anelka and Real Madrid dressing room story? Because obviously Alvaro is biased for the Spaniards, which I completely understand. So I'm going to be biased with the French, having spoken to Nicolas about it many times. First day he arrived at the training ground, there's no locker for him. He has to wait until everybody is sat down and sat in the corner. There's no locker for him. None of the Spanish players said hello to him. The only ones who said hello were Jeremy, Christian Carambe, obviously, that he knew from France and with the national team then. But Jeremy and Samuel Leto were the other two that spoke French. But none of the Spaniards pretty much never spoke to him. And he had a feeling from the beginning that he was not welcome there. And Eto and Jeremy said to him, listen, we have to tell you, you're not going to be happy, but before you arrived here, all the players were talking together and saying, like, they don't understand why the club signed you. We already have Morentes. We have Raul, obviously. And they didn't want you here. The players don't want you here. And Anelka, who, like Alvaro said, was very young and very stubborn at the time and through his whole career anyway, said, OK, if it's going to be like this, then I can also cause trouble here. And I think from day one, really, it was just not going anywhere. And I'm not surprised that despite all his talent and despite those two goals in the semi-final against Bayern, who really save Real Madrid, because in the second group stage, Bayern Munich won 8-3 over the two games against Real Madrid. They battered them, the home and away battered them. And no one really thought that Real Madrid could actually beat Bayern Munich in those semi-finals. And Anelka's two goals made a big difference. But he was, from day one, he said he didn't want to be there in the first place. He didn't want to leave Arsenal and certainly not to go to Real Madrid, and left after that season to go back to Paris. But he really never felt like he was welcome and wanted there.
Well, one thing I really admire about Anelka is that he did the things his own way from a very early age. He had the personality. I think that he just couldn't cope with everything that playing for Real Madrid involved at the time. What I said about Vicente del Bosque is true. Vicente del Bosque said that Anelka in the locker room just got really angry when he scored his first goal, because apparently, according to Anelka's version, nobody celebrated that goal with him. That is what Vicente del Bosque says. But there are a few things that Anelka did that were considered at least eccentric. Number one, he left the training ground once in his car's booth, and his brother was driving because he didn't want to meet press. And then his style was probably too too much for a rather conservative society. I don't know. But he was rolling up his one of his trousers legs. And he was walking like that in Spain. And I remember that that got a lot of fun from media too. So what? I think that just the wrong moment for Anelka to be there. And I'm not blaming Anelka. I'm not blaming Real Madrid. I'm just saying that the moment was not quite right for Anelka to be there.
Right. Turn-ups on the field, yes. Turn-ups off it, no. So that was him, and he had got them through to the final. So let's then deal with the events of the 24th of May at the Stade de France. What happened when Real Madrid took on free-scoring Valencia?
Ahí está la pelota, metido la cabeza para despejar Pellegrino, McManaman, gol, 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 gol. Y ojo a la contra para el Madrid, se marcha solo Raúl, ahí está Raúl, desde el centro del campo, va a ganar a Cañizares, Raúl puede cerrar el partido, la final, la octava, ahí está Raúl, 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 gol, 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 gol,
gol. Wow, 3-0 to Real Madrid. Pick of the goals from Steve McManaman, the third goal pretty special. Valencia, just one shot on target, and perhaps the most one-sided final that the Champions League has ever seen. Jules, you were there.
I was, James. I was indeed in the stands, and Alvaro can talk about the final better than me. But from being there, the feeling very, very early on, literally the first 5 minutes, was that it was going to be men against kids, and that Valencia players who was all this was so new to them, were going to be far too nervous compared to a Real Madrid team who's most of that squad or some of that squad had just won the competition 2 years before. They were very much used to that kind of environment and the final and the tension and the pressure and everything. And they walked over them. It was enjoyable. It was a nice final because Real Madrid played really well and McManaman scored a lovely goal, but there was no contest. So it would be like, we were there and it was a lovely day, and it was just a bit like, okay.
Did the occasion get to them, Alvaro?
I think that probably yes. I believe that it helps a lot if you score the first goal first, and I think Real Madrid did more to deserve that. It also helps the fact that the manager was confident that he was going to stay next season, because Vicente del Bosque was given a contract extension the day before the final. So all those things obviously help. There was a player who wanted to vindicate himself, Raúl. He played the 1998 Champions League final. He didn't score that time, and it was basically a crusade for him. He wanted to score that day, and he managed to score the third goal of Real Madrid. And I believe that probably that season it became clear that Casillas and Raúl were going to be two of the stars of Real Madrid in the seasons ahead. Casillas that season had played his first game in 1999, and he became Real Madrid goalkeeper, and he won the Champions League being 19 years old.
That third goal is hilarious, though.
It's bizarre because, all right, Valencia trying to get back in the game, but there's still 15 minutes to go, and Raul gets it from a Valencia corner, cleared up field. He runs from his own half, and every Valencia player other than the Canizares is behind him, and he has loads of time to, and to be fair, lovely round the keeper and then finish with his wrong foot behind the onrushing defender, which is just very, very good. But even so, I mean, there's desperation, and there's like, you know, mega
Basically the entire Valencia team are in the Real Madrid box. Meanwhile, what about Macca's goal? Red 5 says, in conversations about Real Madrid great Steve McManaman's name never gets much coverage. Is he regarded as a true Galactico in Madrid? How was he seen in Spain, Alvaro?
The answer to the Galactico thing is no, but he will be remembered as a very good Real Madrid player. And in Spain, he managed to adapt his game a little bit. When he signed from Liverpool, he was a really fast winger. And in Spain, he switched a little bit to the centre, and he became more of a passing midfielder. And he got really good campaigns in Spanish football. That bicycle kick goal, or I don't know how you... Bicycle volley,
scissor
I don't know
kick.
How would you call it. That he scored in the Champions League final. Well, he scored another goal like that also in La Liga. So he became a little bit of an specialist doing that as well. And he was a player with plenty of charisma as well. And like Anelka, he got a really good integration in the locker room. And unfortunately for him, there was a time when Real Madrid decided that it was, you know, time to depart, to part ways and sign different players. But McManaman had, I would say that, really complete time in Spain, and definitely he helped Real Madrid midfield a lot.
And he remains one of only six English players to ever score in a Champions League final, and the only one to do it for a non-English club as well.
The other thing for me for the final, being there at the stadium, was, and we talked about Redondo before and that game in Old Trafford, but seeing him play, and again, this was easy for, it was an easy game for him, for all Real Madrid players. So but he was so elegant. One of the most elegant players I've ever seen live. And that's the only time I've seen him. I've never seen him in another game live. Just the charisma that he had, the elegance. It was just beautiful to see. And again, it was an easy game for him. There was nothing special in his performance. He was in control from first minute to the last minute, like the rest of the team. But he was just so elegant, and that left foot was so beautiful. And for Anelka, that's the last game he played for Real Madrid, and he was back in Paris where, you know, obviously he was born. So it was a special moment as well. And I think it was a two-finger sign to everybody in Madrid and the fans, and everybody saying, like, you see, I got you here with my goals in the semi-final. We've won this together. Now I can go and he will win the Euros with France. And when we looked into the 97-98 season and Real Madrid winning that, and we said Christian Carambo won the Champions League and then we'll win the World Cup with France, and not many players have done that in their career. Then Carambo won this one, although he didn't play in the final, and then goes and win the Euros with France as well a few weeks later.
Nice. Of course, Anelka famous for another two-finger gesture later on in his career.
Obviously, this final was in 2000, the start of a new decade, start of a new century. And, you know, people look, what's going to happen, you know, for the future, for glorious future. One thing I noticed about the Real Madrid team for this final is that four of the players ended up in that decade getting signed by Sam Allardyce, which is possibly not what they envisaged on that warm evening in Paris. So you had Campo, Anelka and Fernando Hierro all at Bolton, and Michel Salgado at Blackburn. So just shows you can never predict the future.
And one more thing, this is on a more serious note. I mean, the country dominance became a thing in Champions League the minute more teams were invited to the competition. And since that maiden final between Real Madrid and Valencia, there have been 7 European Cup finals featuring teams from the same country.
Good Lord.
Yeah, 7. And from 1980 to 2000, there were teams from 9 different countries winning the European Cup. But from 2000 until now, only teams from 5 countries have won the Champions League. This is a little bit unexpected, maybe, because when the Iron Curtain fell, it looked like those countries from the East were going to be able to reach our financial levels from the West of Europe. But it has become very obvious that it's been West Europe who has been dominating football after the Iron Curtain fell.
And Real Madrid in particular, Álvaro, this was number 8. They're now up to 13. Of course, Valencia would be back to try their luck in the final the following season again with Héctor Cooper in charge. And guess how that went? We'll be talking about that season next time round. Any final thoughts, though, on 99-2000, Jules, Álvaro, Duncan?
Yeah, only one more about Real Madrid, if I can. Real Madrid president at the time, Lorenzo Sanz, thought it was a good time after winning the Champions League to call elections because he thought he was going to win. But somebody called Florentino Pérez appeared there saying that he had signed Figo, and the rest is history. Florentino won the elections in summer 2000, and the Real Madrid Galactico time officially started in summer 2000.
Well, we'll hear more about that, Álvaro, next week when we touch on the 2000-2001 campaign. Right now, though, it's time to conclude today's Totally Football Show with round 2 of the Intertotally. All right, welcome back, Carl Anker.
Hello, everyone.
And welcome back, Michael Cox.
Hi, James.
Hi to you, Michael. Michael, of course, with a 2-point lead from the specialist subject round. And now it's all about the general knowledge. Carl, you need an absolutely huge performance here.
Yeah, a bit nervous. But
okay.
Here we go.
Let's crack on then with your questions. Question 1, Carl. At which club did Ronaldo the Phenomenal, the Brazilian one, end his career?
The last club I can remember him playing for was AC Milan.
No, it was Corinthians.
No. Okay, it's fine.
Question 2. Who said, when questioned about why he had taken a colleague's plate during a pre-match meal, when you're the king, you can do what you want?
That would be Alan Pardew.
That's correct. Question 3. Which manager's first job was at Bournemouth and his most recent at Middlesbrough?
Tony Pulis?
Is correct. You're level now with Michael Cox. This to take the lead, Carl. Who were the first team to knock Real Madrid out of the European Cup?
Ever?
In the history of the competition, yes.
Ooh, blimey. I have no idea. History of the European Cup. have to be champions at the time. Hamburg? Why not Hamburg?
No. No, it was Barcelona.
Tried to be cute, ended up being ugly.
So, question five then, Carl. Which Qatar-based team is Xavi currently the manager of?
I would not want to disgrace myself by trying to pronounce it, because it'd just be a guess, so I will politely pass, unfortunately.
It's Al Sadd, Carl, which you must be, because you only got 2 out of 5, which means that you are level with Coxie. If Coxie fails to answer any of his general knowledge questions, we're heading for a tiebreaker, but just one correct answer will take him through to the semi-finals. Michael, are you ready then for general knowledge?
Yep, hoping to not do a Pat Nevin.
If you could just get them all wrong to the last one, that'll at least preserve a bit of tension. Let's see how you do anyway. Question one. At which club did Ronaldo, or Phenomenal, the Brazilian one, start his career?
I think it was Cruzeiro.
It was. And you're through to the semi-finals where you'll be taking on Jack Lang. I know you'll want to do the other general knowledge questions.
Of course.
Question two. Who said, it was a freakish incident. If I tried it 100 or 1,000,000 times, it couldn't happen again. If I could, I would have carried on playing.
Freakish incident.
If I tried it 100 or 1,000,000 times, it couldn't happen again. If I could, I would have carried on playing.
Oof, I can't think of an answer to that one. Let me, hang on.
Can I get one?
yeah, go on. Carl.
Might this be Roberto Carlos?
No.
Damn.
Although it would have been appropriate. Without the if in that sentence.
No idea on that one, James.
It was Sir Alex Ferguson on accidentally kicking that boot that cut David Beckham's
back.
Question three. Which manager's first club job was Blackburn and his most recent Southampton?
Blackburn and Southampton. Don't know. Pass.
I know this one, I think.
Go on then, Carl.
It's Mark Hughes.
It is. Question four. Who was the last team to beat Real Madrid in a Champions League or European Cup final?
Champions League or European Cup final? Struggling to remember Real Madrid losing one. Sorry, I have to pass that one as well.
It was Liverpool in 1981.
Really? Okay. Wow.
No. Question five. Which Japanese team is Andres Iniesta currently playing for?
Oh, is it the same one as Podolski? But I can't remember which one it is. I will guess at S-Pulse.
Incorrect, Michael. It's Vissel Kobe. So, you've scored 1 point out of 5 on the general knowledge, but that is enough to take you through to a semi-final with Jack Lang. 1 point, though, out of five.
Yeah, disappointing general knowledge round. I'm relieved I got the first of those 5 questions right. Otherwise, I really would have been panicking.
Yeah, absolutely. Carl, I'm afraid you leave the Intertotally for this season at least.
Antoine Griezmann, we hardly knew you. Great effort, Michael.
Yeah, that was a good battle. And now Jack Lang in the next round, which I'm looking forward to.
I mean, you have to defeat Jack Lang.
I do hope so. I know I've got Emma Saunders' many considerable supporters on my side for that one.
Well, there you go. Michael Cox is through to the semi-final where he'll be taking on Jack Lang. The other semi-final featuring Daniel Story against a certain Alvaro Romeo. Alvaro.
Yeah, I've been preparing already. Fittingly, I will be answering about Real Madrid Galactico time. So I managed to put together the research of this podcast into the quiz. I thought that was a clever way of doing it.
If you need any Jonathan Woodgate information, give me a shout.
Of course, man. I will. On his tattoos.
Real Madrid in the Galactico era won't be the only thing you're answering on, Alvaro, because, of course, with the semi-finals, we've introduced some UEFA-style changes of our own with home and away ties. You'll each be answering questions on each other's specialist subjects. Boom.
Boom.
What? Away answers count double.
Announced in the regulations pre-season. I think you have to put it in the regulations COMEX before the season starts.
I think the COMEX voted for it, so it's fine.
Yep.
I'm going to challenge this to Cass.
Anyway, the first semi is Alvaro against Daniel, and that will be coming up in this weekend show, available Sunday night or Monday morning, depending on your time zone, listener. That wraps it up for today, though. Julien, any other nuggets before we depart?
I don't think so. I mean, I thought it was a very good recollection of this quite wonderful Champions League season.
Oh, that's lovely. How nice. Alvaro, Duncan, many thanks to you for your participation and you, Jules. Look forward to speaking to you all again soon. And listener, thanks for being with us. We're back this weekend with Matt, James Horncastle and Daniel Story. For now, from all of us here, it's goodbye.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, a Muddy Knees Media production. For sales and advertising, please email sales@muddyneesmedia.com. Keep up to date with everything across our Totally Football network at The Totally Show on Twitter, and make sure you check out our brand new website too, thetotallyfootballshow.com.
Muddy Knees Media.